Hey guys, my name is Crystal Kenny, and I'm in love with creating. All things artistic and imagination involved. I'm an American girl who chased her creative dreams all the way to Paris, France, making a living using photography. This podcast takes you inside the stories of all the artsy folks I've met along the way and gives you that extra push to discover your creative gifts. The desire to create is deeply inside each and every one of us, and I give you the tools and inspiration to find a new way of living a more creative life. This is La Vie Creative, the podcast. Claudine Hemingway is a descendant of famed writer Ernest Hemingway. We bumped into each other at a party and decided to team up and dive deep into French history, but with a twist, by bringing a spotlight to those lesser-known creatives in France. This is History with a Hemingway. So welcome back to Paris History avec a Hemingway. Today we are talking about my favorite museum in Paris. I'm obsessed with this museum. I probably go a couple times a month. I think this is my Louvre because Claudine's obsessed with the Louvre. I'm obsessed with the Musée de Rodin. I love the Rodin Museum. If you haven't been, you need to go. And Claudine's going to tell us the history of the wonderful building that houses this museum.
Yeah, the Rodin is a pretty fantastic museum, and it's small. So it's not one of those that you could do this and, go in there and then have lunch afterwards and then, and then go to the Louvre.
And there's never a line at the Rodin. It's like empty all the time.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's kind of off the beaten track, but, it is amazing. And it has a really great story. So it was originally built for Abraham Parin de Morat. And he was born in 1686, and he was a very wealthy wig maker.
A wig maker?
Yeah. Well, at the time, the king and everybody would wear these wigs, so it was a good thing to be into. I don't think right now, unless you made the Raquel Welch collection, I don't think you're going to be buying a mansion.
True. A wig for good money. That's good money.
But he was also the confidant and good friend of the Duchess Louise Francoise de Bourbon. And she was the legitimized, we just talked in last week's episode about not legitimized, but she was the legitimized daughter of Louis the 14th and Madame de Montespan. But Madame de Montespan, we did a whole podcast episode about her. She was the one that was into the witchcraft.
The evil lady.
And so she actually, because of Madame de Maintenon, who came along after her, the other, and she was kind of the secret wife to Louis the 14th, she urged him to legitimize these children. So Louise was legitimized. The architect that built what we know as the Musée Rodin was architect Jean-Jacques Aubert, who he also did the Palais Bourbon, which is what Louis François had built. And he also was involved in Chantilly, the beautiful Chantilly, and also Chalet, which is where our other gal we used to talk about was Nellie Jacquemart. That is where she ended up buying and has part of her museum there.
Wow. So he built all the best places.
Yeah. But it was built between 1727 and 1732 on the Rue de Varennes over there in the 7th. It's right next to the Les Invalides, which is now the Musée de l'Armée. And so it was way out there. And at the time, it was like way out in the country. Like this was way on the outskirts of Paris. In 1682, Louis the 14th had moved and taken the court out to Versailles. And so at that time, at first, Paris basically was, there was nothing happening in Paris. There was just the people that lived there. But then a short period after the beginning of the 1700s, all these people were like going back to Paris, all these people that had, that were all part of the court and had all this money. They were going back into Paris, building these huge mansions because they had the money now. And there was all this space. So now when it's really strange when you think of some of these places, when you walk around in Paris and think how like this was the middle of the country, there was all of this land around it. And now, you're in the 7th, the 6th, the 7th.
It's packed.
And now it's packed. So he had this built, and in 1736, so just shortly after it was finish, he ended up dying, and his widow rented it out to Louise-Bénédicte de Bourbon-Condé, who was the wife of Louis-Auguste, who was another legitimized child of Louis XIV. So it was his friend's brother now.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. So I know you kind of need a whole graph sometime.
I need a chart.
Yeah. But she was quite the party animal. She suffered insomnia. So she would hold all these parties late at night there, making everybody attend them, even though I'm sure they were exhausted, but she didn't care because she couldn't sleep. And so why should anybody else?
Yeah.
But she is the one, when you go into the Musée Rodin now and you look at like the rooms that have the beautiful carved wood moldings and the paintings over the doors, she's the one who had all that installed.
It's so pretty. It's like Versailles.
It's very pretty. And, again, it's not huge. It's small. And when you think of museums and stuff,
yeah.
1753, she died. And it was sold to the Marshal de Biron, who was Louis-Antoine de Gontaut, Duc de Biron. And this is what it's known as today. The building itself is known as the Hotel Biron. So I don't know why the other guy, maybe because his name was harder to say.
Why did they name it after the first guy?
I don't know. It's interesting. They do this sometimes with buildings. Sometimes the building is named after the person who first built it, but then sometimes it's just known as somebody later on. So I don't know if there was just, it just stuck or.
Yeah, that's strange.
He actually has a more checkered past than the Whig guy.
Yeah.
Now we're changing the names on everything, but it's still known as the Hotel Biron. So he was a marshal under Louis XV. He is the one that had the garden, which is one of the best parts about the whole place. He had the garden extended. At the time, it was twice the size of what it is today. And it's still pretty good size for being.
Yeah, it's still really big. I can't imagine it twice as big.
Yeah, he had it designed. He had it doubled in space, and it was designed by Dominique Madeleine Moisset, who basically, he also was involved with some stuff at Versailles, but this is basically what he's known for the most. But Biron would die in 1788, and his nephew, Armand Louis de Gaton Biron, is the one who took over it, but he never actually lived there. So it was under his supervision, and he would let the widow of his uncle stay there.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, he was one of the soldiers under Louis XVI. He ended up going over to America to take part in the War of Independence. But then he returned in 1783, and he ended up getting caught up in the revolution and had his head chopped off on New Year's Eve of all days, 1793. He was 46 years old and was beheaded at the Place de la Révolution, which is Place de la Concorde now.
That's crazy. He survived the trip to America. Mm-hmm. He survived the revolution in America. And then he came back to get his head cut off.
He came back. And then 10 years later, he had his head. But, again, like when we talked about these people, basically anybody that did anything even remotely close to the royalty is even,
they killed him.
Yeah, they brought, they were the ones that opened their curtains in the morning. They were on the chopping block.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. But some say that he might have actually had this secret relationship with Marie Antoinette.
Oh, I like that. That's juicy.
Yeah, but we could all say that now. there's still her relationship with Axel von Fersen, which I've always thought that they definitely had a sexual relationship. And I think she was actually in love with him. Every year it comes out with, oh, now we've actually found this letter and we think it's true. It's like, I think they definitely did. But, it just keeps coming out over time. And, sometimes they discover letters and things like that. It's kind of cool. But back to the Hotel Biron. Under the revolution, it ended up becoming the property of Armand II, who was Joseph de Béthune. He ended up changing it into, he opened up the gardens and had a fairground installed.
What? A fairground?
A fairground. So while other people were getting their heads chopped off and during the revolution, you could go there and go, I don't think it was probably Ferris wheels and big things like that, but at the time. Who knows? but I knew you probably had carousels and fun things like that. And it only lasted a season until it didn't make any money.
Oh my God, imagine.
During the
revolution. So crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Give us bread and give us our fair games. But they tried to also do later on hot air balloon rides from there, and that only lasted a short while. And then the Catholic Church took it over. It was a seat for the Holy See. The Cardinal Giovanni Caprera lived there for a short time. He was the one who crowned Napoleon the King of Italy in May of 1805. He died there on June 21st, 1810, and was interred in the Pantheon until Napoleon III kicked him out and had him sent back to Rome.
Oh, wow. Bye-bye.
Yeah, so we're covering all of the span of time with this, this place. For one short year in 1810, the Russian embassy moved in there. But then in 1811, when it had Russia and France were having issues with each other, they decided they probably better get out of there. And then that's probably its longest inhabitant was in 1820. The Sisters of the Sacred Heart moved in there. They had a chapel built on the property. There was other buildings besides just the mansion and the house that we see today. There was multiple other buildings on the property because it was so large. They had these other ones built as well. They were all part of the Sacred Heart. But in 1904, when France went through a whole period of the separation of church and state, they were basically told to get out.
Get out. Get out.
So, but in 1905, this is when we start to change into what we know more today. The artist Jean Cocteau moved in, and he told a bunch of his other artist friends about this space, including Matisse, who gave classes there, and dancer Isidore Duncan, who would also be dancing and having lavish parties all the time. But on October 15th, 1908, Rodin was told by Cocteau and moved in to the four south-facing rooms on the ground floor.
Mm.
So he ended up moving there. The Sacred Heart Chapel that was built there had Rodin actually freaked everybody out because he would have parties in this chapel that was there. And you really only notice the chapel if you're kind of walking outside of it from like on the street. You really notice it's a chapel, but once you get there, because they've redone it over time, it doesn't really look like a chapel except for on one side. But he would hold these parties there and have naked showgirls dancing on the altar.
In the church.
But it wasn't, you know, it was like unconsecrated. It wasn't, you know, it was no longer a church. It was just at this point a building, and the Sacred Heart sisters had left. But, you know, some people were pretty upset that these naked girls were dancing on the altar, and he was having these crazy parties.
That's so funny.
Yeah. But in 1909, the city was going to actually break up the building and have it cut up into 45 lots and to sell it. And so Rodin was not happy about this. And so he went to his friends, Georges Clemenceau and Aristide Briand, who were politicians, big time politicians in France. And so they jumped in to help, and they petitioned the government not to do that and to actually purchase the building. And Rodin agreed that if they purchased the building, and he would give them his entire collection.
Wow.
So this would include everything that he basically, everything he had. So they agreed to it. And on July 13th, 1911, they ended up kicking everybody out but Rodin. He was allowed to stay there until he died on November 17th, 1917, at the age of 77 during World War I.
So he kind of got a free home by donating all his art to the government?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it was a lot because he also had the home in Meudon, I think is how you say it. And it is also a museum, a Rodin museum. It's currently closed right now for renovation. And I couldn't find when it was hopefully reopening, but it's just right outside of Paris. And so that was also donated. So, you know, he basically gave everything he had to France.
Wow. I was wondering how I got that place. Was he very rich, Rodin? Did he have
He was very well known. I mean, he was like Picasso and Rodin and a couple other, you know, there's a good handful of artists that were very famous, even when they were alive. You know, sadly, some of these artists aren't, you know, like when we think of Van Gogh, you know, he sold one painting in his life while he was alive. So Rodin was very, like, everybody knew Rodin. He was very well known and was making a lot of money when he was alive.
His naked parties sound fun.
His naked parties, yeah. Well, if you really look at the sculptures, you could really see how maybe those parties went down. But on August 4th, 1919, it was finally opened as a museum. So not even 2 years after his death. Of course, it probably would have opened sooner, but 1918 was the end of World War I. And so 1919 is when it was opened. His collection of sculptures, his photos, engravings, his documents, and even his furniture, his personal collection of paintings, everything, it's more than 32,000 pieces.
Wow.
What was given to France.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not a big museum. So just imagine, I mean, when you think of the Louvre, and the Louvre is, 15 kilometers, if you laid it out, it's 35,000 pieces on display. And that's only 35% of their collection.
Wow.
And basically the Musée Rodin's collection is as much of what you see on display in the Louvre.
Yeah. I really love his museum because the sculptures, a lot of them are like very sensual. I'm like, this guy's like this old, gross, fat man. He's sensual.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole nother side of him that, we'll save for maybe a different day. But there's, there's a whole nother side of, like, there's a lot of people that are having issues with because of the way he treated women and some other things. And I mean, we talked about Camille Claudel, who I just love and breaks my heart every time I think of her. But yeah, I mean, maybe his very sensual sculptures, there's a reason why.
Yeah, definitely there's a reason behind that. Yeah.
But the garden of the museum is amazing. It was under Biron, who is basically, like I said, he's the one who doubled the size. It basically was transformed into more of what we know today. It was inspired by André Le Nôtre, who was the garden designer to Louis XIV. He's the one that did Versailles, Vaux-le-Vicomte, the Tuileries. He's the one that kind of mapped out the Champs-Élysées. So he's very classic French, very, everything's very geometric. It was inspired by him. It's changed in size, of course, over time. It's half the size that it used to be. And a lot of the buildings that are on there, some of them were destroyed. There is a building on the side that was part of when it was the convent. And it is now basically, it's kind of like an outdoor sculpture room, and it's basically just this all glassed, and there's a whole bunch of his some plaster models of some of his pieces, but you could basically walk outside and you could see all of those. So some of the it used to extend more to the left if you're looking at it, and so now it's still very big.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, it's so the part where they have the sculptures in the garden now in that glass, that used to be the church?
No, the church is on the front side. So yeah. When you walk in, basically where you go to buy your ticket,
yeah,
or go to the gift shop, that's the church.
And what's the building that the sculptures are in?
That is that used to just be part of the church. I think it was just another building, nothing.
Yeah. Nothing, it looks like just like a farm thing or something.
Yeah. I mean, it basically just looks like a glass box.
Yeah.
With, columns in between for windows, but that's it. Nothing really. I mean, the church is really like when you're outside, if you're standing there looking at the thinker and you look to your right, you get to see like the beautiful Gothic arches of a church. And and that's where I'm always like, wait a minute, what is this? But when you're inside, you have no feeling of that whatsoever. It's a lot more contemporary inside.
Yeah, it doesn't look like a church at all.
Not at all, which is kind of sad because outside it's really neat. But in 1908, Rodin was the first one that actually put some of his sculptures out into the garden, but he didn't really do anything after that because it was left alone basically until it opened as a museum. After his death, Claude Monet was actually instrumental with how things were actually placed and, pushing for it to be, how it was going to be designed. At the end of Claude Monet's life, just last, the anniversary is just last week, on November 11th is when he donated what he called his grand projet or grand décoration. And he, that's where he decided to give to France at the urging of Clemenceau again. to give his huge paintings of the water lilies to France on the end of World War I.
Wow.
And so when he gave those, he gave them under stipulations of how they would be displayed, and he would also be involved in actually how they would be displayed and the room. And so for years, they were trying to figure out where to put these. And one idea was to build a building at the Musée Rodin in the garden that would hold Monet's water lilies.
Yeah.
But they decided not to do it because the building would look way too contemporary against the Louis XIV style of that is the Musée Rodin. So that's when Clemenceau later was like, hey, what about one of those buildings in the Tuileries? What about the Orangerie? And so that's what they decided to do. And Claude Monet actually had the rooms designed to be oval in shape because they would be the perfect shape for the paintings. And then also that the ceiling would have skylights in it that would be of diffused light. And so it would basically also, so when you go to France and you go to the Musée de Lingerie, go in there, if you can, go in there a couple times and go in like maybe once in the morning and then once in the afternoon, because the daylight actually changes the images.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because that's where he, you know, later he's known for his collection of, you know, his paintings of the haystacks and the cathedral in Rouen, and he did this multiple times because he painted them at different times of the day. And so he wanted that still to now naturally happen with his paintings because he painted the water lilies to be different times of the day.
I like that. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Sadly, Monet didn't live long enough to see the finished piece, but we all get to now.
Yes.
Yeah. So the interior of the Musée Rodin still has some of the paintings from the 18th century that hang there. In the museum, they've changed it a little. I just was there a few weeks ago, and they definitely moved some of the things around from when I was there, you know, before COVID. Which is nice because they do have such a huge collection. I mean, they probably only have a third, if even that, I don't even think that, of what they actually own on display.
Yeah, I believe it. There's not that much space. Yeah,
I mean, probably more like an eighth because it's not a huge space. And then, you know, you have these huge, sometimes huge standing sculptures that, you know, they take up a lot of room as well. But the museum split out. It starts basically with his training as a youth, and it basically is first pieces in 1860. And then it goes through and shows like his large scale pieces that he did that were for, you know, public display in different gardens. Of course, there's Balzac statues and then that whole story, which is interesting. There's his Victor Hugo. There's also a room, basically they recreated what his studio looked like when he did have it there. And it's in the room that was one of his studios. It's really interesting. So they like recast a bunch of different sculptures and some other pieces that, you know, weren't his, but he collected and he just loved. One of my favorite rooms in there is this room that has his own collection of art because, you know, he was friends with Monet and all these people. And one of my favorite ones is the painting that he has by Van Gogh. He has what's on display is some Van Goghs and some Monets. But the painting he had that was by Van Gogh is a Pierre Tanguy. And he basically made paint. And so he had all these pigments and he had this store that was, down in Saint-Georges just below Montmartre. And all the artists would go there because they just loved him. And they even said that he didn't maybe always have the greatest quality of paint, but they loved him so much that they always went there and bought from him. And sometimes when these artists couldn't pay, they would basically pay him in paintings.
That's cool.
And these aren't just any artists. These are, of course, you know, Toulouse-Lautrec, Monet, Pissarro, Gauguin, and of course, Van Gogh. And so they would go there to visit him because they would say it was like going to a museum, because you'd go in there and visit and talk to him and get your paint and then look up on the, you know, wall and see these amazing paintings. I always wondered what happened to these paintings. After he died, the artists all organized a auction and basically had all these paintings sold to help his wife and his children, because they were basically left with nothing. So, but this one painting of Pierre Tanguy was purchased by Rodin. He bought it from Tanguy's daughter, and he always kept it in his collection. And it's really cool. Like, it's very different from any Van Gogh you see. It's a portrait of Tanguy in the middle. And then behind him, it's all of these copies that Van Gogh did of Japanese prints. And Japanese prints, Van Gogh loved them, and the Impressionists loved them because of their use of color. So those block prints, you know, like everybody knows, like the Japanese one of like the huge wave. And so they really inspired all the Impressionists and Van Gogh. And so I love seeing that painting, and it's a pretty good sized painting because of what's in the background. It's just really cool. And I'll put a picture of it up on my website. But another room there, of course, is the Camille Claudel room, which is too small. It needs to be much larger. And some of it are her actual sculptures, but then some of the other pieces, like there's pieces that Rodin did of her. And you know, we did that episode about her that we'll link back. And she was amazing, and it's just heartbreaking how the rest of her life went on. But the museum itself is really cool. It's what's you walk outside. You could go just outside if you want. You don't have to go to the museum. I think it's only a few euros, 4 or 5 euros, I think, just to go to the garden.
It's 2 euros for the garden. It's so cheap.
Oh, so cheap. And then you could go, there's a little cafe out there. So you could go out there and have lunch and just walk around. There's tons of sculptures in the garden, and also that outdoor one as well. One thing that Rodin is really known for is for the Gates of Hell. And what you might not know is that a lot of the sculptures that you see all over the world are actually pieces from the Gates of Hell.
Oh, so, I didn't know.
Yeah, his two most famous things, The Thinker and The Kiss, were pieces that he had created for the Gates of Hell.
Okay.
So the Gates of Hell, he was commissioned in 1880 to create something for what was going to be the Musée of Decorative Arts. And it was going to be where the Palais d'Orsay once stood, that was burnt down in 1871 in the Commune. And now, of course, we know that is what became a train station. A train station was built there and then turned into the Musée d'Orsay.
Love it.
So in turn, now you could go to the Musée d'Orsay and see the plaster, his first plaster sketch, they call it, even though it's a three-dimensional. It is his first plaster sketch of the Gates of Hell is in the Musée d'Orsay. So it kind of ended up going where it needed to go. But if you really look at that, it was basically the year after he was commissioned for it, they said, we're not doing this. But he still worked on it. He worked on it until his death for 37 years. Before that, he had sketched many of the figures that he had imagined from the story, Dante's Inferno, which is the 9 layers of hell. And so he had already kind of sketched out these people and these stories. So it was something he worked on, you know, for probably 40 some odd years of his life. The Thinker, of course, that is on the very top of it, that's either thought to be of Rodin himself or what he imagined Dante would be. But Dante has a very distinct face that has been captured by many, many artists and sculptors, and has a very distinct nose. And the Thinker does not have that nose. So some think maybe it was actually, you know, what Rodin was imagining of himself. also The Kiss. But if you look closely at the Gates of Hell, the actual, what we now know as The Kiss, is not on it. It's a different interpretation of that couple. But it's really fascinating to look at it. I want to learn about every single one and who each one of them are and where you could find them. So I found actually a book in the sales bin of all places at the Musée Rodin, all about it. And it actually even has like a little picture and like a little legend. And so you could say, this is this one. So I'm quite excited. It's on my list of 4,000 other things to do. but it's, you know, it's really cool to look at the gates of hell in the garden. You go just walk right when you walk in and you look to the left, there is the bronze version of it. And so you could go see that for just the €2, but you kind of, when you look at it, kind of think of what you see in a church. So if you go to, you know, when you could go to Notre Dame and you look at the doors, back then, you know, when they were creating these huge Gothic cathedrals, a lot of people didn't read. And so between the sculptures and the statuette on the front of churches and the stained glass, that's how people were taught the stories of the Bible, and also, you know, terrified by them, because, you know, you'd see the last judgment, you'd see these devils and scary things. And this would be like, yep, don't do bad things, because that's what's going to happen to you.
Yeah, exactly.
So the gates of hell is kind of on that. It's kind of, you know, funny, because you think of it, you don't think the gates of hell is a church, but it's under the same kind of idea of like telling these stories and like, hey, don't do this, because this will be bad.
Yeah, exactly.
But he, you know, he worked on this up until the end of his life. It's thought to that Camille Claudel also worked on some of the pieces as well. But there's another amazing group, a statue group, that's the Bourgeois de Calais, which he also had created in 1884. The mayor of Calais asked Rodin to create a sculpture to commemorate the 1346 event that happened during the Hundred Year War, when Edward II of England was attacking the city of Calais for 11 months until they surrendered. And so Rodin had decided that he took this part from Jean-François's book of the Chronicles of France, and he recreated these six men led by Eustache St-Pierre. He has a rope around his neck, and he's coming with basically his hands open. He's kind of leaned over because it's thought that he has like the weight of France and the people on his back, coming to the king. And they basically turned over the keys to the city. This really happened. Turned over the keys to the city and like begged him, like, please stop attacking and killing us.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
So when you look at the sculpture, and it's all like that was the only one that Rodin identified by name. But over time, they figured out who all the other figures are, and I'll put them on the website. But you do see some of these figures separately. So there's Jean Dare, who is one of the men in there. He's also in the garden just separately as himself. There's the three men at the very top of the gates of hell, where you see, you know, you'll see one of the men, the man on the left, is also out in the garden. So you'll see these figures together and all over the place. You are also, because I'm sure most people listening to this, depending on where you live, could say, oh, I have a thinker in my city, or we have, you know, one of these, because they legally can make 12 copies from the original cast that Rodin created.
Only 12. There's one in Baltimore.
Yeah, there's one in Baltimore. I think there's a sculpture garden at Stanford that has a bunch of pieces. There's a Rodin museum, I believe, in Pennsylvania that has a bunch of pieces.
Yeah, you're right. It is. Yeah.
But you could see a lot of these things, you know, all over. Because I remember going to San Francisco years and years ago, and I was like, they have a thinker? Like, you know, when I came to Paris, I was, you know, a long time, I was like, big deal, there's one in San Francisco. But now I know, because and the Musée Rodin is self-funded, so it's not funded by the state. So I mean, I'm sure they get a little bit of money, but basically during COVID, when all these places were closed and all of them were like desperate for money, Rodin announced that they were, you know, creating some sculptures, and they were going to sell them that hadn't already made the 12.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know what ended up happening. I just remember there was a huge push for that. And then I haven't seen or heard anything since then. So I'll have to look into it and see what I could find. But I mean, I'm sure that would go. I mean, coming from the original, you know, cast that he created, it would have to be a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. It's going to support them for a little while.
Yeah. And that's what happened at the when Camille Claudel's, her niece, was trying to have her museum created that's just outside of Paris. She ended up taking some of the cast and having copies made and selling them to help fund and create this, her museum. And the country, France, actually got involved in it and basically took her to court. She was fighting this for over 10 years in a French courtroom. And she ended up not getting tried for it because they were trying to say that she wasn't legally allowed to make these copies and sell them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because we remember what we remember about Camille Claudel's story is her brother Paul was a giant jack. And his name, it makes me so angry when I'm in the Rodin and they have this huge wall that's, you know, thanks and dedicated to, you know, the people that donated and his name is on it. And I took a picture flipping it off. Maybe I'll find it. But I was just like, oh, you big jerk. You threw her into like basically into the crazy house for the rest of her life when she shouldn't have been there. And but your name's going to be here on the wall like you so proudly gave to the Rodin. It just makes
jerk.
Yeah, we hate him. So yeah. You could go to the Rodin. It's open Tuesday through Sunday. It opens from 10 to 6:30. It's closed on Mondays, of course. It's €13 to go. But you can go there and check it out. You know, the last time a day you could go is about 5:45. But you know, they do special exhibits as well. They have in what is now what was the church. They have an exhibit space there. Recently I went to go see that they've been doing this really cool exhibit in conjunction with the Picasso, and it's called Picasso Rodin, and it's a special exhibit at both the Rodin and the Picasso. And it's really cool. I'll post some pictures from it. My favorite, I think, was at the Rodin where they have the a plaster version of the Kiss. And in the background is this painting that Picasso did of two people in a kiss. And it's really cool to see, even though, you know, these two artists were, you know, basically right towards the end of Rodin's life is when Picasso first came to Paris. But Picasso, it's stated in the one at the Picasso that he had gone to this exhibit and he had seen all these Rodin. And there's actually a sketch that he did of Rodin, like just on a piece of like a scrap paper. I'll post it. It was really cool how they kind of put the two artists together and how each, you know, how Rodin inspired Picasso. I don't know if it was as much the other way around because it was towards the end of his life, but it's really interesting to see that goes on until January 2nd. So if you're going to be there for the holidays, go check it out.
The best.
Very cool.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and make sure you check out Claudine's website for more pictures and information and join her for her virtual tours every Sunday. And we can't wait to chat with you guys again next week. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to Paris History Avec A. Hemingway. If you want to find out some more, you could always find me on my Instagram page, Claudine Bleu Blanc Rouge, and that's B-L-E-U, as in the French way to spell it. And each day I post a daily history lesson about a person or a place or something in Paris, or it's lots of fun facts. And then also at claudinehemingway.com, where you can also sign up for my newsletter there.